The sequence of events is set off by the most unlikely of conversations. The acts that follow are brutal, cold, and inexplicable. A weekend of violence, greed, and cold-blooded murder is about to start. And six people from completely different worlds will forever be bound together. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 190, A Deadly Weekend. Make upgrading your home security a priority with Ring's range of smart security devices, indoor and outdoor cameras, video doorbells, and alarms. Ring products are easy to install and allow you to monitor your home from your phone or tablet via the Ring app, no matter where you are. Ring will be running massive home security specials this month from 24 July 2025 until the end of the month, where you can save up to 50% on selected Ring devices. Visit Takealot, Incredible Connection, Hersh's, and Computer Mania for more information on these deals, available while stocks last. With Ring, you're always home. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa. /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Tasneem Bucks, Cody Samuels, Amelia Daling, and Marilise Swart for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Corruption within our police service is quite the topic right now. So when I was researching today's case, I thought it interesting, sad, and infuriating to see how that very element had played into this tragic and devastating case. Especially since this case happened in 1998. Now, as you'll hear, what happened in this case is quite different to what's being alleged is happening in the upper levels of our police service. But I think it has much of the same effect. When those who are tasked with serving and protecting us go rogue, innocent people die. In researching today's case, I used a chapter from the book Now You've Gone and Killed Me by Lynn Sampson, court documents, and several media articles. So, let's get into episode 190, A Deadly Weekend.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Many of my episodes are structured around the paths that victims and perpetrators take through their lives and how those paths end up crossing. In today's case, we have 6 primary victims and 4 perpetrators. But because this case is 26 years old and happened in a pre-digital media era, there's very little information about the background of most people involved. So I'll be taking you back as far as I can with most. With each individual involved, I'll take you up to New Year's Eve, 1997, going into New Year's Day of 1998. As that is really where all the paths collide. Marilise Xenia Holmes was born on the 18th of March 1969. Although I was not able to 100% confirm this, it appears that Marilise was born Fundamava, and she'd been married, with her married name being Holmes, but she divorced her husband. Again, there was only one source that mentioned this, so I stand to be corrected, but every other source names Marilise with her surname as Holmes. Marilise attended the Free State Technicon and the institution that was at that time called the University of the Orange Free State and is now called the University of the Free State. And after graduating, she began working in the tourism industry. As apartheid fell in South Africa and our country started to evolve into a possible tourist destination, Marilise took great pleasure in arranging tours of the country for foreign tourists. She'd especially set her sights on Cape Town as a brilliant destination to sell. And in 1997, she struck a deal with American Express to sell tours specifically to their Australian clientele to Cape Town. It was during a business trip to the United States around this time too that 28-year-old Marilise met 33-year-old Edward Keim III. Edward, who was affectionately known as Ed or Eddie, was a business owner in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He'd actually grown up in the Midwest region of the United States, but 9 years before, he decided to move to Florida so that he could combine his love of water sports with his other passion, elaborate sound systems. Eddie had opened a business in Florida that kitted out high-end yachts and other watercraft with sound and audio-visual systems. He'd done so well and enjoyed the lifestyle so much that soon most of his family saw the lure in Florida too, and they'd moved there to join him. When Marilise and Ed met in Florida during her business trip, they'd experienced an instant connection. The successful, handsome young American had immediately fallen for the pretty blonde South African woman with what to him was a unique sounding accent. Although the pair didn't have much time to spend together while Marilise was in America, they exchanged numbers. And by the time she was back home, they were already planning a trip for Eddie to visit Cape Town. Marilise's friends said that although she was taking things slowly with Eddie, they could see that she was really infatuated with him, and they'd never seen her happier. The couple were so eager to see each other that Eddie originally planned to spend Christmas in South Africa, but his family had been very unhappy to hear that he wasn't going to spend the holiday with them, and so he changed his plans and instead flew into Cape Town 4 days before the new year. Eddie had never been to South Africa before, so he was a tourist in the true sense of the word. Lucky for him, he probably had the best person he could have chosen to show him around in his budding romance with Marilise, the tour operator. Over the initial days of their time together, Marilise took Eddie to all the popular attractions in Cape Town and surrounds. They visited wine farms and the waterfront, had picnics on the beach and deep conversations well into the night in the shadow of Table Mountain. The couple saw in the new year together. No doubt, wondering what wonderful things 1998 might have in store for them. and how their relationship might progress. While Marie-Lise and Eddie were just finding their feet in a new relationship, 45 kilometres from Cape Town in Somerset West, Maggie and Mike Knott were on the other end of the continuum. They had been married for many years and were happily settled in Somerset West, enjoying the coastal vibes. As the new year dawned for the older couple, they received an invite from friends in Durbanville to visit their home on Friday the 2nd of January. The couple accepted the invitation and looked forward to a day of socialising and fun with their friends. Around the same time, Pastor Andries Manders, who went by Dries to distinguish himself from his 10-year-old son, also named Andries, was enjoying some time off. His son was on school holidays, and Dries had a bit of respite from his daily duties as a clergyman for his church. The Manders family lived in Stellenbosch, 20 kilometres from the Knotts in Somerset West, and 50 kilometres from the young budding couple Marie-Lise and Eddie in Cape Town. As Dries carried out a few errands he simply didn't get time for during the year, his son accompanied him on the drives in the family's white buggy. Cape Town is very much a picture of the haves and the have-nots. That picture is not immediately clear to most people, especially those visiting for a holiday who spend their time at the tourist hotspots, which are breathtaking. But if you spend enough time here, I've lived here for 10 years now, after moving from Johannesburg, where I lived for 34 years. If your eyes are open enough, you start to see the reality. It's a reality that presents in many, if not all, popular tourist hotspots in the world. It's not uniquely South African, but in our case, it is most certainly deeply influenced by our history. Over the years, Cape Town has become a desirable place to live for many South Africans. And let me be clear, I do feel lucky to live here. When I moved here, I felt like I'd moved to a different country, because things are so different from Johannesburg. But I also want to be clear that the vast majority of people living in Cape Town and on its outskirts do not have the same experience of the province. In fact, only the minority do. It's in places like the Cape Flats, Khayelitsha, Langa, Bonteheuvel, and others that the truth of Cape Town and the Western Cape is laid bare. These areas were created by the Group Areas Act during apartheid and were purposefully placed far enough away from the city centre that a distinction between so-called white areas and areas for black and coloured people would be made. As a result, these areas are far enough away from universities, large hospitals, and often work opportunities, that what should be a simple daily trip to university for a student living in Khayelitsha, for instance, means taking several different taxis and hours of commute time. The other side of this is that this distance, isolation, and the resulting poverty has ensured that these areas have become huge crime hotspots. If you haven't listened to my episode about the numbers gang and how apartheid policies contributed to the creation of gangs in South Africa, I strongly recommend you do so. In a domino effect, the high crime rates has made it less likely that already desperate communities will get the service delivery they need, as they are essentially held hostage by criminals. Just yesterday, the Cape of Good Hope SPCA had to cease their services in Khayelitsha because their SPCA inspector suffered an attempted hijacking. And it's not the first time that's happened to them. They've had to make the difficult decision to protect the safety of their inspectors, And now the people of Khayelitsha and their pets, who so desperately need the assistance of the SPCA, will not be able to access those services. That's just one example. In the Cape Flats, where gang violence is so prevalent, it's well known that ambulances will not immediately attend if a gunshot wound is called in. Paramedics have been caught in the crossfire of gangs too many times. I've heard people say, well, if the honest citizens are in the majority, why don't they just stand up to these criminals and take back their neighbourhoods? Usually, that is said by someone who has never experienced having to be careful what colour shirt you wear in case you get mistaken for a rival gang member, or not allowing your children to play in their front yard because they may get shot by a stray bullet. And all in the knowledge that a lot of the time, the police are as scared to come to your rescue as you are. Are there interventions happening that could help to swing the pendulum? Yes, there are. It's not all doom and gloom. But I think it's incredibly important to remember the reality of the situation when we hear taglines like, Cape Town voted best city in the world. Because in brackets behind, it should say, for the few hundred thousand living in selected areas and tourists. So why have I spent the last few minutes telling you all this, and what on earth does it have to do with this case? Well, I always feel like context matters. And it would be really easy to tell the story as the age-old tale of baddies who do bad things and hurt innocent people. But I think there's a deeper story here. One of the two sides of one city, and what happens when those two sides collide. But more than that, even with that one side, there are layers. We think we know what and who criminals are. We have this idea of what a gang member or a hijacker looks like and how they spend their time. And really, so often, we have no idea. While Murrelise and Eddie, the Knotts and the Munders, were welcoming in the new year, and planning for a fresh new beginning that New Year's always feel like they'll bring. In Mitchell's Plain on the Cape Flats, a man was having a conversation with a police officer. It was a conversation that would change the lives of at least six people, and so many others, forever. Zamil Parker would eventually become a state witness. But in December 1997, he was very carefully straddling the line between being an ordinary citizen and occasionally dipping into the underworld of Cape Town. He was an ice cream salesman by day, but he was also the guy you went to if you wanted to procure very specific things. Zamil was known as the man who could organize cars, and really anything car-related. You give him your specific request, and he would do his best to find it. And if you think Zamil was just really connected to car dealerships and knew who had what stock at what time, you would be wrong. That's not how the people he relied on got the cars. You've heard me talking before about how car hijackings and thefts are rarely random. Sometimes a car will be stolen just to be used as a getaway vehicle or because it was an easy steal. But for the most part, hijackers and car thieves work to very specific orders. Someone wants a certain car, and the message gets passed down, and the individual or the gang doing the hijacking or theft starts looking. And if they spot you in a car they have on their list, it's likely to be a very unlucky day for you. From a business perspective, this makes sense, right? You wouldn't make some really custom item just to sit on a shelf. You'd make it if you had an order for it. These criminals know that every time they go out to get a car,
They may not come back, either because they'll get killed or they'll get arrested. So they're far less likely to randomly pick a car and risk that on the off chance that they might find a buyer. I realize I'm speaking about this like it's a legitimate business, and this totally negates the victim's experience. Let's be clear, it's organized crime, and victims often can and do die for their vehicles, which is horrendous. But I do think that understanding the true nature of these kinds of crimes can be very helpful. So at the end of December 1997, Samuel Parker received a request. This request came from a police officer called Sergeant Leon Dawes. The man is named in multiple media articles, but I will state up front that I cannot find any outcome of criminal action taken against Dawes. So please know that what I'm saying about him is what those who would eventually go on trial in this case would say, and I cannot say for sure if he was ever found guilty of anything. Sergeant Dawes wanted a new car. He specifically wanted a maroon Toyota Corolla. Zamil told Dawes that he'd see what he could do. For the most part, I firmly believe that those who used Zamil as a middleman to find cars for them knew exactly where those cars were coming from. Even if you were completely unaware and thought he was a legitimate car dealer at first, the cloak and dagger stuff that came afterwards would flag even the most naive person. But Zamil was part of a network that would later be blown up. He wasn't just stealing cars, selling them on, and hoping for the best. The network had all their bases covered to ensure that these vehicles would not be easily traced. And it was no coincidence that a police officer had approached Zamil with an order either. Eventually, it would be revealed that at least 25 individuals in law enforcement, the traffic departments, and the SAPS were involved with the network at some point. The process worked as follows. Zamil would get an order and pass it on to the gang. The gang would go out, identify a vehicle that matched the order, and wait for the best opportunity to take the car. Mostly, they wanted to take the car when the owner was in it. This made it more complicated, but it also ensured that there was less damage to the vehicle, because they didn't have to break in, hotwire it, and maybe override security features like gear or wheel locks. And of course, they'd have the keys, which was vital to secure a sale. Once they had the car, they would go to a scrapyard and find a wrecked car that was similar enough. They'd purchase the wreck and secure that vehicle's paperwork. They would then use their contacts at the licensing department to have a duplicate set of paperwork printed without the scrapped status on it. Then take the stolen vehicle to a clearance centre where they'd also pay off someone to get road clearance, matching the stolen vehicle to the new paperwork, fit new license plates, and their stolen car was now reinvented as a clean vehicle. Of course, a closer inspection of the vehicle itself and a deeper look into the paper trail would quickly reveal the truth. But at first glance, it was a saleable vehicle, which they then hand over to the person who placed the order and receive their cash. Zamil worked with several different gangs, but the individuals he selected for the police officer's order were four men who were well known to him. Whether or not he knew how these men planned to operate was another question entirely. But he certainly knew, when he called up the man who seemed to be in charge, that people weren't going to be willingly handing over their cars to these men. And there would be guns involved. Shortly before New Year's Day, Zamil passed the order on to Rashad Peterson. Of the entire gang, Peterson is perhaps the least likely offender, but it was clear that he was just hiding under the radar. The 28-year-old did not have a criminal record, and he owned a fruit and vegetable store in Athlone, which netted him 20,000 rand in profit a month. He'd matriculated, he'd done a diploma at Technicon, and he came from a middle-class family. He just had a baby with his girlfriend, and her family was so taken with the young man that they would later tell a journalist that if they had six daughters, they would marry off all six to Peterson. He was that much of a stand-up character in their minds. Among Rashad's cohorts were three other young men who carried less of the shiny citizen profile: Marshall Andrews, Daywood Dastigier, and Charles Marcus were all in their early 20s and all had previous records, substance use histories, and difficult home circumstances. They received the message from Peterson on the 1st of January 1998 that there was an order for a maroon Toyota Corolla. They planned to start their search the following day. And it is at this point that the fates of all those I've spoken about so far begin to collide. As Michael and Maggie Knotts drove to their friend's house in Durbanville on Friday the 2nd of January, they knew nothing of the four men who were setting out on their search that day. And it's perhaps the complete randomness of all of this that is so disturbing. That those four men's paths would happen to cross with that of the Knotts on the very day the men were looking for a car that was far too similar to the one that they were driving. The horrible tragedy of the fact that the Knotts didn't even live in the area they were spotted in. And if they just left a few minutes earlier or later, or turned down the invitation entirely, they would likely never have known the horror of what the next few hours held for them. But they did. As the Knotts left their friend's home that night, Peterson and his gang spotted them. The car the Knotts drove was actually a maroon Opel Kadett, not a Toyota Corolla as the order requested, but the men seemed to think it would be close enough. The gang followed the Knotts all the way to their home in Somerset West. At 7:50 p.m., the Knotts' neighbours reported seeing their vehicle pull into their driveway. The witness didn't watch the events that followed unfold, but did hear the car pull away at speed again shortly afterwards, and noticed that there were now two people in the back seats of the Opel as well. Around the corner, the two other men would have been waiting in their car, and followed behind as the Knotts were undoubtedly forced to continue driving. With regards to the Knotts, as well as the other victims, we don't really know who did what in terms of the gang members. This is because the only two who would eventually stand trial would claim to be innocent of the crimes, and others involved who turned state witness weren't actually there when the hijackings took place. It's always difficult to understand in a situation like this why the hijackers would take the victims with them when it really just makes their jobs harder. But it really comes down to delaying police response to their crime. The thought process was probably that if they forced Mike and Maggie out of the car and left them in their driveway, they could quickly alert police, provide a description of the vehicle, and police would be on their tails in minutes. A smart criminal, and one who wasn't out to cause physical harm, could force the victims not to look at them so that they couldn't identify them, and then drop them off in a relatively rural spot, safe and unharmed. And this would still buy them the time they needed. But those were not these criminals. this gang, seemingly believed in leaving no loose ends. Neither we nor Mike and Maggie's family know what horrors they endured between the moment those two men got into their car and the moment their lives were ended. But they would not see the dawn of the 3rd of January. With the gang now having the vehicle which they hoped was close enough to the order, they drove to Zamil Parker's house. He'd already had others working the paperwork end of the job, and although he wasn't terribly happy that they'd arrived with a different model car, he told them that they should see if the client was happy with it. The client, of course, was a police officer, and it seemed that that was no secret, because the next stop for the gang, bizarrely, was Mitchell's Plain police station, where Sergeant Dawes was stationed. Unfortunately, Dawes was not on duty, so in an even more bizarre move, the men parked the vehicle outside the police station and left the keys and a note for Dawes on his desk. Of course, by this point, the vehicle had not been reported missing, and neither had the knots. It would take a few days for their absence to be noticed, and that would be all the gang needed to wreak even more havoc. When the gang saw Parker that night, the man had told them that he had another two orders. One was for a white Bucky, and the other was for a sound system which would fit a very specific model BMW. It seems the gang took that Saturday off, though. Peterson likely had responsibilities to tend to in his fruit and vegetable shop, and so the four future victims would be given a single day's reprieve. But by Sunday, the 4th of January, the gang was back on the road. Dries Manders and his 10-year-old son were driving in his white Bucky in Stellenbosch when the gang spotted them early on Sunday, the 4th of January. We don't have Manders' exact testimony, but we know that a similar scene to the knots played out, where two of the men forced Manders to drive while they sat in the back of the Bucky with guns to his and his son's head. The group took the father and son to a field near Mulder's Flay train station. There, Dries Manders, now wholly convinced that these men were set on killing them, started talking. It's difficult to say whether the gang found killing a child a bridge too far, or whether Dries telling them he was a pastor and they should keep in mind that killing a man of God was a sin they could never take back, was the thing that did it. Whatever it was, it worked. The gang tied the pair up and then bound them to two trees. The area was pretty rural and quiet, so while it was not ideal, as Dries could have no idea when someone would find them, they were at least alive. The gang fled in Dries's Bucky. Strangely, the gang members did not take the Bucky back to Parker afterwards. Instead, it seems it was agreed that Dayward Dastiger and Charles Marcus would hide it near their own homes. There was talk from the two men about them possibly heading out to Durban after they had completed their list, to lie low for a while. Then they would sell the Bucky there, they decided. First, though, the gang had a sound system to find to finish the spree. And by the time that was finished, the four men would need to run as far and as quickly as they could. So Dastiger and Marcus hid Dries Manders' Bucky, and while he and his son remained tied to trees, helpless and waiting for someone to find them, the gang was on the move one final time. On Sunday, the 4th of January 1998, Eddie and Marilise had lunch at a wine farm in Stellenbosch. They then drove back to the waterfront in Marilise's green BMW and met up with friends. The epic movie Titanic was still showing in cinemas at that time, and the group of friends settled in to watch the three-hour-long movie. It would be between the point of the couple leaving the cinema that night and their arrival at the popular beauty spot Signal Hill, that's the gang spotted the green BMW. As Marilise and Eddie pulled up to spend some time watching the nightlights twinkling from the hill, the gang struck. What followed was undoubtedly a period of complete horror for the victims. Again, we don't know who did what to the couple, but the evidence would show that Marilise and Eddie were first taken to Monwabizi Beach near Strandfontein. Over the years, the beach has become a well-known dumping ground for the bodies of murder victims, and this was one of the first cases of that happening. It would be there that Eddie Keim III would lose his life. His face was pushed into the sand to stop him from screaming, and he was shot once in the head. Marilise was forced to watch. Then they drove away with Marilise in the car, stopping a few kilometres down the road near a rubbish dump. There, Marilise was raped and shot in the head. Afterwards, the gang took what they wanted from Marilise's BMW. All they needed was the sound system, which they expertly removed. They had no use for her car, and its metallic green shade was far too noticeable, so they drove it down the road from where they'd left her body and set it alight. In the early hours of Monday, the 5th of January, all four men returned home. They'd handed the sound system over to Parker, and their money was on the way. For them, the weekend of theft, murder, and rape was over. But for those who were about to discover what they'd done, the horror was just beginning. Not long after the gang members had laid their heads down on their pillows, calls started to come in to police stations across the Cape. Dries Manders and his son were eventually found, and although traumatized, dehydrated, and bruised from being manhandled, they were alive. The officers who took Dries' statement noted his descriptions of the men and put out an alert for his bucky. The other calls were bleaker and more horrifying. A man walking to work spotted Eddie Keim's body on Monwabisi Beach just an hour before Marilise's body was discovered by a council worker at the rubbish dump a few kilometres away. It would take some time for them to be identified and the connection to be made between them. Then the bodies of Mike and Maggie Knott were discovered. Mike had been shot in the head, but Maggie had first been strangled and then shot. As news began to trickle out of the four horrific discoveries and their possible links with the father and son tied to the trees, news outlets across the world began to cover the story. Eddie Keim's family in Florida received the horrific news that their son would not be returning from his trip to South Africa. And just as the country had started to earn a reputation for a great new place to travel to, the crime spree began to have people questioning how safe it really was to travel to South Africa. It is undoubtedly for this very reason that within 48 hours of the victims' bodies being found, 20 investigators were assigned to the case in what would become one of the biggest task teams formed in the province's history. Police informant networks are often vital in cases like this, and it would be one such individual who would help to produce the first major break in the case, just 2 days after the victims were found. Alida Davids was a well-known figure in Mitchell's Plain. The woman carried the nickname Mother America. She was another person who seemed to carefully straddle the fine line between the ordinary world of the average citizen and the underworld. She'd been a hairdresser and a secretary to a criminal lawyer in her life, and it would emerge she'd also been a police informant on occasion. From the information she produced, it also seemed she was someone people felt comfortable bringing stolen items to. Alida would tell police that two men had arrived at her home in the early hours of Monday, the 5th of January. They'd had a metallic green BMW and a cell phone they wanted to sell. Alida had declined and turned the two men away. But when a neighbour had reported seeing a metallic green BMW outside her house, she'd had no choice but to provide the names of the two men to police. And this is how Daywood Dastiger and Charles Marcus came to be on police's radar. Soon, roadblocks were set up around the area the men lived in. The rumour of their impending trip to Durban had emerged, and police blocked off any route the men might be able to take out of the area. It didn't take very long for the white bucky belonging to Dries Manders to be spotted heading toward one of the roadblocks. It seemed the two men hadn't expected the investigation to move quite as quickly as it had, and they'd left their departure for KZN too late. Officers at the roadblock quickly moved all the other vehicles on as the bucky approached, and they prepared for a gunfight. They knew the men were likely armed and probably would not go quietly. And they weren't wrong. As Dastiger and Marcus approached the roadblock, they suddenly floored the accelerator of the bucky, signalling their intention to mow down anyone in their way. Gunshots echoed through the air as the dust settled. The white bucky skidded to a halt, and then, very slowly, rolled forward. Both men were declared dead on the scene. It didn't take long for experienced investigators to link the two deceased gang members to their two cohorts. And 3 days after the victims' bodies had been discovered, Rashad Peterson and Marshall Andrews were in custody. Evidence against the men was quickly developed. Dries Manders looked through a lineup of photographs and identified all four men as those who had kidnapped and held him and his son. In addition, Peterson's fingerprint was discovered on the mechanism of the sound system components removed from Murrelly's Holmes's BMW. There was no physical evidence yet linking the men to the Knotts murders, but their vehicle would become the key to that. Before that could happen, though, a serious error almost resulted in absolutely no justice ever being secured. Because of the disparity in evidence between the Manders and Holmes Kime cases and the Knotts case, the charges for the crimes had been separated, and the men were charged separately for them, resulting in two separate court processes ensuing. In March 1998, when the two men appeared for the Knotts case, the prosecution advised that they were going to be temporarily withdrawing the charges while they continued their investigations. In the background, the links to Sergeant Leon Doss had already been made, but that had to be kept under wraps because it clearly led to a whole network of other officials who investigators did not want to tip off before they were ready to make arrests. Unfortunately, on the day the two appeared in court, the magistrate, seemingly unaware that the pair were also charged with other murders, kidnapping and more, upon hearing that the charges had been withdrawn on the Knotts case, released the men. Of course, Peterson and Andrews weren't going to put their hands up and remind anyone that they had other charges against them, so they walked out of the courtroom and went home. They were rearrested a few hours later when the mistake was discovered, but this could have been disastrous if the pair had decided to flee. Not long after this, Sergeant Leon Dawes was arrested and the Knotts car was retrieved. He was released on bail, but suspended from his duties as a police officer. He claimed to have had no knowledge that the vehicle he'd purchased was procured criminally, and that he'd only ever dealt with Parker and believed the man was getting cars from dealerships. Dawes would be further linked to the gang members, though, when it was discovered that after getting the Knotts car, he'd sold his own vehicle to a sister of one of the gang members. The trial against Peterson and Andrews would span 8 months. Parker turned state witness, and although he was not present at the crimes, He was able to link all four men to the orders he'd passed on for vehicles and the sound equipment. He also confirmed that the men had shown him the Nazis' vehicle and handed over the sound system from the BMW to him. Alida Davids also testified about how the two deceased gang members had arrived at her home with Marilisa's car and cell phone. In addition to the corruption exposed in the various departments the gang had used to make their schemes work, this case also exposed a number of people within the community who were essentially playing both sides, connected to the underworld, but also feeding information to the police. Two witnesses who testified in this trial would be found murdered in the weeks after their testimony. Alida Davids was one of those people. Within weeks of her delivering her testimony against the gang, she was found shot to death in her home. Her murder has never been solved. This case would also be one of the first in South African history in which cell phone evidence was heavily relied upon. Peterson particularly found himself caught in the web of his own digital trail, one he'd likely had no idea at the time he was leaving behind. His alibi of having been at home with his girlfriend and baby the entire weekend when he wasn't working at his shop was blown apart when police showed that he'd in fact used his cell phone at two of the crime scenes. Rashad Peterson had a lot of support in the courtroom throughout his trial. His girlfriend came to almost every session with their baby, and her family were often present too. They insisted that Rashad was innocent. Marshall Andrews apparently played a Game Boy console throughout the court proceedings and seemed completely unbothered about what was going on around him. In August 1999, 20 months after the murders, the saga finally came to an end, when both men were found guilty of all 13 charges against them. Hearing the news in her home in Florida, Eddie Kime's sister Tina said, "It took a year and 8 months, but it's finally over. It's been an unbelievable struggle, and we weren't sure we'd ever see this. But when I heard the verdict this morning, I started crying all over again." During the judgments hearing, it was revealed that the prosecution planned to request that Sergeant Doss's bail be revoked, as he'd been accused of intimidating and interfering with witnesses. The death of two of the witnesses from the trial that had just ended was also worrying to prosecutors, as they wondered how many would make it through to a trial for Doss. Sentencing procedures for Peterson and Andrews started quickly, but the judge immediately made it known that he would like the dangerous offender determination to be considered for the two offenders, and as such they would have to undergo a psychiatric evaluation. While this delayed sentencing for a little while, it would prove to be worthwhile in the long run, as this determination was eventually handed down to both men, along with life sentences. The dangerous offender determination, of course, would override any parole implications attributed to a life sentence, and the judge ruled that the two men would be brought before court again in 30 years to determine whether either should be reclassified or possibly considered for parole. I'm sure, at the time, when the families heard that the men would next appear in court in 2029, it felt like a lifetime ahead. But now, it will happen in just 4 years, if the men are still alive. I'm not entirely surprised that I couldn't find anything more about what might have happened to Leon Doss or any of the other police officers, traffic officials and others involved in the network. The SAPS will often try to keep cases like this out of the media spotlight, as it understandably puts them in a very poor light. In addition, at the time, I'm also sure that there were powers above and beyond the SAPS pushing to have this case wrapped up in a bow and put away to limit the whispers among possible tourists and investors about whether South Africa could really trust its police service. Whether or not justice was served in that context, we all know very well that corruption like this continues on to this day in one form or another. And it's not just in South Africa. There are crooked cops everywhere. But I think this case perfectly highlights just how deadly corruption can be. The people who were getting paid off for turning a blind eye or putting a stamp on a document that didn't comply and getting a 50 or 100 rand note slipped into their pocket in exchange likely told themselves it wasn't a big deal. People were going to steal cars anyway, right? And that's what insurance is for. And if they ever allowed themselves to consider that people might die for these vehicles, I'm sure they pushed that thought away very quickly. I think what gripped me most about this case is that although the spree itself may have been relatively unique, the concept of the fragility of life when cold-blooded criminals walk the streets is not new, and it's ongoing. Mapping out the paths of the victims and the perpetrators made me realize with fresh terror just how easy it is to find yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time. None of these victims were doing anything high risk. The Knotts were just driving home. The Mundos were running errands. Marilise and Eddie were just exploring the fringes of what might have been a wonderful new relationship. The things that made them targets were not within their control. The Knotts and Mundos happened to drive a car someone else wanted. And Marilise just had a sound system that would fit into someone else's car. Eddie was just along for the ride. 1 minute here or there, or a different vehicle colour choice years before, may well have been all the difference between life and death. And that is a terrifying thought. But it's also not entirely accurate. Because the choice between life and death was never really in the hands of the victims. The Knotts leaving their friends 5 minutes later, or the young couple deciding to head home instead of one last stop, wasn't really what did it. They may still have ended up in the paths of these men. But in the end, the choice was in the hands of those four gang members. It was all a bit random, but they still had to choose to kill those people. They could very easily have left them in a rural spot, just like they did with the Mundas. If no one had been killed, I can guarantee you there would have not been the huge public uproar and 20 investigators assigned to the case. They probably would have gotten away with the cars. And I think Rashad Peterson is proof that it was a choice. The other men had a choice too. But I'd be more convinced that they were stealing cars. Certainly not raping and killing, but perhaps stealing cars. For the financial benefit alone. But Rashad Peterson didn't need to steal cars. He had a really good life. So clearly for him, it was less about the money and more about the power and control over the other men in the gang and over the victims. I don't believe that this deadly weekend was the first for this gang, but if police did identify any other cases they were connected to, it was never made public. Maybe it just didn't warrant spending more taxpayers' money to bring them to court, because two were already dead and the other two were facing a very long prison term, with the most severe legal determination the legal system had to offer already passed down. I will tell you that this case made me wonder about some of the missing person cases we see where people disappear in their vehicles, and neither are ever found again. Sure, these victims were left where they could easily be found, but that might not always be the case. I always find it weird how certain cases are incredibly disturbing to me, and it's not always the ones that involve very strange psychopathic behavior or gruesome injuries to victims. More often, it's the ones that highlight the fragility of life. How you can just be going about your business, completely oblivious to any threat. And suddenly, someone decides, today is the day, and you are the one. 2029 is just 4 years away. And I really hope these men will be denied the possibility of parole. But there are so many more just like them out there. I think as we as a country start to move through these new allegations of corruption within our police service and wonder how seriously to take it, we should think about this case. You may have heard of the butterfly effect, the theory that a butterfly flapping its wings somewhere can cause a typhoon somewhere else. Well, I think this case is a bit like the criminal butterfly effect. The traffic official slipping a 100 rand note into his pocket somewhere, resulting in the brutal deaths of four innocent people. It sounds unbelievable, but we've just heard how it can happen. And if you're ever on the receiving end of any item whose origin you're not quite sure of, that item that's in chuckle tones and awed mentions of how cheap it is because it fell off the back of a truck, consider that perhaps you too are setting off a typhoon somewhere else. Maggie Knott, Mike Knott, Marilise Holmes, Eddie Kahn. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.